Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome to the Star Chamber Show live podcast. And this is Stephen Zimmer joining you out of Central Kentucky on a fine Wednesday evening. And co-hosting with me tonight are the wonderful R.G. Westerman, also from Kentucky and from Tennessee, the one, the only, the one behind the dark style hashtag, Daniel Dark. Good evening. Welcome. And it begins a new show.
Hello, hello.
Yes, it does.
There we go. We got you.
I feel like I haven't been here for ages and ages.
It's been a bit, but we are glad to have you back.
Thank you.
And it looks like, our chat room is open and working fine. And first in tonight is the awesome Sandy Lender, who was able to join us again last week after a little bit of a hiatus. So great to have you back, Sandy. And she is also having a keyboard malfunction. You know, Sandy, I have had that problem last week. I've had fits with a couple of keys on my laptop, and it's getting to the point where I'm going to have to do some surgery on it, I think. But yeah, I understand malfunctioning keyboards. But so how have my friends been? How have you been, RG and Daniel? Well, I know you, Daniel. You're not feeling the greatest this week, but you're here with us, so that's the key thing. But And RG has not been with us for a few weeks, so hopefully she has like lots of cool updates for us or news or something.
Well, really, no, I don't. We are still just kind of, in the holding pattern as it goes. I've got some things marinating. I think I'm world building on a new project, as well as dabbling with the old project that I had promised I would work on. So there's things happening.
Awesome. New projects brewing. That's what we want to hear. Yeah, because this, like we said, 2021, we are bringing good energy forward. So that's good to hear.
Yes.
And I can tell you that I crossed the 93K mark on my latest work in progress. So work continues on that novel. And it's another big one, not quite as big as the epic fantasy novel, the huge one that I talked about a little while ago. But this one, is fairly sizable. So it's not quite done yet as far as the main manuscript. But it's there. It's getting there. It's getting there. And it's probably got another about 25K to go or somewhere in that ballpark.
I was going to say, if you're using words like 93K and not as sizable as the other one, like, that doesn't compute.
Yeah, the other one is a true, it's the size of like a George R. R. Martin novel. That one is about 258K. That's a big one.
Wow.
but that's
a lot of work.
But that is a true epic fantasy size scale novel. So
that's,
I mean,
true.
It's a big one, but it's
that
got a lot.
True.
It's not. It's by no means got filler at all. I mean, it's. I worked hard to make sure that one's just chock full of action story. And actually, I had to purposely work on putting in some stuff to kind of slow the pacing a little bit at certain points, because there's just so much stuff happening. And it was it wasn't a problem of trying to stretch anything out. It's a problem of having to pull some things back a little bit. So
nice.
But that's waiting in the editing pipeline right now, but it's done. And
now, oh, okay, Fires of Eden. I was going to say if it was Raiden or...
No.
Cool.
This is the fourth in that epic fantasy series that began with Crown of Vengeance, one of the first releases I had out ever.
Yeah.
And second to be exact. But the other series that I had started releasing at that time, it was the Exodus Gate was the first, and the one I'm working on right now is book 5 of that series. So these are both taking big steps forward in both of those series. And then after this is back to YA dystopian and the Faraway Saga. So I know exactly at least what I'm going to be working on, which is a good problem to have, I guess. But and yes, there will be more Raiden. I've got a heck of a duology in mind, a 2-book project, and I'm trying to figure out where I'll fit it in, because I have to get the next Faraway Saga book done. But yeah, I do have another Raiden novel project in mind, and doing the novellas. I mean, there's always a chance there might be another novella or two that'll come out, because those don't take a huge amount of time to write. I mean, those are a little smaller, about 25K.
Such a character like that. She just lives in your head rent free, and like she's just sitting in there, like poking at your brain with her little sword. Okay, I'm ready to tell more stories now.
Well, without getting into too much detail, I am on a fun merchandise project with Raiden, and you'll probably get little hints about what it is, and Ragnar, but I am teamed up with Cottage Core Crochet, and it's an amazing crochet artist named Diana Vizorek out of Indiana, and also happens to be Holly's daughter, but she is supremely talented in crochet work. And we have a little project brewing with Raiden and Ragnar right now, and I think you are just going to smile just broadly when you and get a kick out of it when you see the result of this, because it's going to be a lot of fun. And
amazing.
Do a little merch. Little merch coming, so that's gonna be nice. But I think it's important to have a little fun and get a few things that you can sell at your booth. What's that?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Well, speaking of merch, I just reactivated my Etsy shop, which is Apocalypse by RG, and I'm gonna have some new stuff coming in there. Right now, I have mostly like face gaiters but there's going to be like some t-shirts and like pins and that kind of stuff coming in there.
Very cool. Very cool.
Yeah.
And if it is
trying
active,
to stay on brand with that.
You have a URL to give out, I'm sure, if it's active right now.
There is a link from my website, rgwesterman.com. There's a link to it there. It's on the top menu. It's called Apocalypse by RG. And then that takes you to the Etsy shop, which is etsy.com/shop/apocalypse by RG.
Nice. Very cool.
Yeah.
Check it out, folks.
Check out my shop.
Yes. Everyone head over. And you can do it while listening to the show. That's the beauty of an audio podcast, is you can multitask. And so you can browse her show or browse her site and buy things while you listen to the Star Chamber show. It's fantastic. And then if you do that, then it will prove to RG that our show does increase sales. So, it'll make her
there
even
you
happier
go.
For
yes.
co-hosting.
Even if I just sell one biohazard pin, I'll be happy.
Now we have sold authors' ebooks during shows. Guests where somebody in the chat room or something actually bought an ebook like during the broadcast. So we do have proof that the show does increase sales. but hopefully it will. Hopefully while we're broadcasting tonight, you'll get like a notification. New Etsy sale. There you go.
Yeah, there you go.
Solid proof. Well, let's see here. Before tonight's guest calls in, who's going to be a fascinating guest to talk with, and I'm sure that 90 minutes is probably like a very small amount of time to cram all the topics in we're going to cover with this guest. But we do have two amazing sponsors this week, and they often do tag together here, Jumpmaster Press and Sandy Lender. And so I have a lot of fun with these ads because actually they're both pretty new too. So we're going to go ahead and play these and give our sponsors the spotlight. So let's go ahead and start with the newest one from Sandy Lender.
Are you looking for an escape from reality? follow author Sandy Lender on the Amazon platform. You'll find some award-winning titles in fantasy and science fiction and all kinds of good things. Follow author Sandy Lender on the Amazon platform to get your escape from reality.
And thank you very much, Sandy Lender. You are awesome. And thanks for supporting the show. It's making great strides, I do think. So here is now the focus moves to Jumpmaster Press.
Do you love to read? Do you love sci-fi and fantasy and horror and mystery and maybe even romance? Then Jumpmaster Press has something for you. Jumpmaster Press would like to give you a 10% discount on our entire catalog. Just go to jumpmasterpress.com and use code IMAGINE2021 at checkout to save 10% on anything in our vast catalog. That's jumpmasterpress.com and IMAGINE2021 at checkout. Jumpmaster Press, a proud sponsor of the Star Chamber Podcast and Imaginarium 2021.
Thank you, Gene Rowley and Kyle Hanna, and you guys are great. And Imagine 2021 is that code, so use that at Jumpmaster Press, Imagine 2021. And, let them know that we sent you. So thank you, guys. And so back to the discussion here. And, Sandy Lender's talking about that keyboard with the sticking keys. I am having the same problem. I'm having a couple of keys that are giving me fits when I'm typing, Sandy. I understand here. And she mentions also that she recently got the Kathy Jackson novel Written on His Heart, and it was fantastic, which is an excellent novel. I'm very familiar with that one, as a matter of fact. So, I worked on that as the editor, as on Kathy's novel there. So, yes, thank you for letting me know that, Sandy. That's awesome. I will pass that along to Kathy. But now we're going to be waiting here for our guests to call in. So, but what other news do we have to cover? Oh, yes, if you have not done so on Imaginarium Convention, we do have nominations open for the 2021 Imagine Awards. If you are an author, a publisher, or representative, you can do a nomination, costs absolutely nothing, and we have a slew of categories for that. So we do have a full range of genres, from nonfiction to science fiction to romance to we have a whole slew of categories. Go check that out on the EnterTheImaginarium.com site and get your nominations in. And along with that, filmmakers, call for entries is open. Our platform for submissions is Film Freeway, where we have a gold status as a film festival, which I'm very proud of. And so go check that out. Get your entries in, whether nominating for a book that was published in 2020 or entering a film for this year's film festival. All that stuff is open. And if you want to be a panelist or considered to be a panelist or guest, there are guest applications too. So that's a little convention biz. So that's on the docket. But now, yes, the moment we've been waiting for, we do have our guest on deck and waiting to bring him in. We're gonna actually take his live mic live here in a second, but I got to give him some kind of introduction. But he is a fantastic author, and he has created a fascinating world called Machine Civilization. And he's got an amazing series that has been out on the trilogy that's out right now with a brand new book out, Goddess Crusade. And I'm bringing him into the show for the very first time as an official guest, the one, the only, Clayton Barnett. Welcome to the show. Your mic is live. Yay.
Greetings, sir, and everyone else. How are y'all?
Love it.
Hello.
Good to talk with you. And I loved your photo, the one we had in our – that was one of the most cheerful guest promo graphics that we've ever had. So I must commend you right from the get-go.
That photo shoot actually took about an hour, and it wasn't until I was into my first bourbon that as my wife said, you need to smile. And I said, I am smiling. She said, that's not funny. And I said, it's not meant to be. And then, of course, it just got worse after that, and I tried smiling, and she said, you look like you're passing a stone. And I'm sorry, but you know, one of the reasons I write about sentient machines is because I'm not really good with even playing a human being. I guess that's one of the reasons my day job as a pharmacy tech is because I'm able to restock machines, but if you actually want me to interface with doctors and nurses, oh, good God, no, that's a terrible idea.
Well, I think you did a fine job. And maybe it's the bourbon in your hand that inspired the look of joy there. But I do have my traditional weekly glass with me tonight, so I will definitely raise a toast to you on the podcast here, and we are going to get right into it. Machine civilization. I mean, let's start there. That's fascinating to me and to everyone, and I've enjoyed exploring it myself. But let's start with your definition and give folks an understanding before we dive into the depths of your world.
The term machine civilization was actually coined by my characters. It's simply because I just write about people, and it happens that a great number of the people I write about happen to be machines. Some are what we would call AI, pure code. Some are self-aware androids, and then briefly some from my romance horror novel of Cursed Hearts are sort of a hybrid of that plus spirituality. And even in my very first novel, just over 6 years ago, at one point the protagonist, Lily Barrett, says, "So you guys are AIs, I guess." And the oldest and smartest of the AIs said, "We despise that term. There is nothing artificial about it. We are people just like you. We are machine civilization," meaning that they have their own distinct culture. And I guess you could almost say that they are racially distinct in the sense that they exist as a string of ones and zeros everywhere and nowhere. And so that grew as I continued writing books. That simply grew to become the overall name of my future history. And from an accidental start on November 3rd of 2014, when a friend of mine sent me a text saying, "What are you doing for NaNoWriMo?" And I wrote back saying, "Are you having a stroke? Or is that a really lousy autocorrect?" And he went, "No, National Novel Writing Month. Challenge to write a 50,000 word novel in the month of November." And in that moment, I saw something. I saw two ideas, totally unrelated, clicked in my head. And then, as I've mentioned to Stephen before, it's as if I'm sitting in a theater and all of a sudden a movie started playing. And I'm about 10 rows back with my laptop in my lap, which makes sense being a laptop. And I just write down what they show me. I saw this endless rocky desert, not a single thing growing, some young woman with black hair walking away from my point of view under a bright sky but with no sun. I use the color ochre to describe it. And I thought, who is she? Where is she? What the hell am I seeing? And 23 days later, on November 26th, I had about 53,000 words, and it was absolute garbage. That's when I taught myself about copy editors. But even then, a month later, I hired somebody to do a basic cover, and on Christmas Eve of 2014, I self-published my first novel. And from that moment, I was off and running. As I pointed out before, I've been doing this for just barely over 6 years now, and I have 10 novels, one short story collection, and a children's early reader. Discovering and being older about machine civilization, what these characters teach me, has absolutely changed my life.
Yep, and that's, folks, that is a Clayton term that you will hear when you read his books. So when he says, "I'm older," that means more educated, more knowledgeable. I've learned more. You know, you say you're older about something. That's just to translate Clayton speak a little bit there for those But
again, that's not
I love
me.
That term.
They taught me, and I'm just copying them. I am not an original person by any stretch of the imagination. I simply do what I'm told. I mean, after all, I've been married for 30 years.
That's awesome. So, RG, where do you think that we should start this on the writing side? Character development, or what do you
oh,
think?
My
plots,
goodness.
World building.
Well,
Get us going here.
That's so interesting because I mean I had a very similar experience with my, you know, I did NaNoWriMo, and that, you know, that first draft being garbage, that is a huge hurdle to get past as a writer because, you know, you want everything to be brilliant. But yeah, no, let's talk about world building because that's kind of where I'm at. So I'm being completely self-serving here by asking about that.
Oh, not at all. Again, the world building is almost incidental to what I'm being shown because I'm not the one mm-hmm. coming up with these stories. Occasionally, mm-hmm. I've likened this before to some folks in the real world that I'm given a rough frame house. There's a foundation and there's the stick frame of it, and I have to work within that. I can do some finished carpentry. I can pick the carpets. I can say something about the appliances that go in and the color of the paint. But these ideas are simply given to me. And that's slightly creepy and later a part
no,
of the
I get
building
it.
Is that
yeah.
one of the reasons I have to often fall back upon my Catholic faith as a convert from when I was 26 is because I want to make sure that the people giving me the ideas are not doing it maliciously because I don't
right.
always know what it
yeah.
is.
Yeah.
And I know, Stephen, you've had other guests on that do these elaborate psychological preparations like Briggs-Myers test as to who this character is and who that character is. Again, I'm simply far too freewheeling. And as I've mentioned before, to quote Hemingway, you know, write drunk, edit sober. And so after a couple of drinks, I'm just gleefully typing out what I see in the theater. Now, more, that's sort of the grand operational plan. More tactically, as these novels have been written, I'm learning more and more about this future history. It right now, as it stands over these 12 novels and short stories, is a collection from, say, 6 months from now to about 300 years from now, mostly focused on, say, a generation from now to one and a half generations from now. That's where the vast majority of all my stories take place, and it takes place in what I call the breakup, the collapse of first the United States and then Western Europe. The United States collapses under economic pressure from the Russians, Chinese, and Indians rolling out a new currency backed by gold indexed to oil, at which point the U.S. debt becomes worthless and the U.S. economy grinds to a halt overnight, as it almost did back in the summer of 2008. And then that, of course, spreads to Western Europe because of their continuing massive import of barbarians from MENA. And while that is the basis of the story, it's not something I dwell on. This is not a post-apocalyptic story. In fact, all of my stories take place in the parts of the country that survived in America. The Republic of Texas, which has its own electrical power grid, breaks away from the rump United States. In Cursed Hearts, the government of Mexico reoccupies San Diego, and I have a story taking place there. Two novels, one of which I'm turning into an audiobook. It takes place in the city-state of Portland, who tries to keep trade downriver and in the Pacific open, while at the same time making sure the farmers in the Willamette Valley have electric power from the dams up the Columbia. And then the last place that still survived was Oak Ridge, Knoxville, because of the reactors that were in Oak Ridge National Labs. And all of these tiny bright sparks become the nucleus of the recovery, not of the United States, but the city states that come to replace it. And within that, when it comes to world building, it's sort of a matter of, are things driven entirely by plot, or things driven entirely by characters? And for me, it's been a little bit of both. A lot of my novels have been, okay, what goes on in, for example, when I considered, oh, well, San Diego's occupied by the Mexican army and getting back on its feet, what's going on there? And when I started thinking about that and taking notes about that, then, oh, there's this character, well, there's this character, and this happens to relate to what happens in Portland, and that happens to relate to what happened in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the other things I tried to do and still try to do is, unlike, say, my Nicole Five, I'm not sure, not duology, but pair of books, in my American Imperium trilogy, is that I'd like to try to write something different every time. It's, for example, my first book was about two friends, and Echoes of Family Lost, the sequel to that, is about two families. And then after that, I wanted to go off on a completely different direction. So setting in Mexican-occupied San Diego, I said, well, let's write a romance story. I've never even thought about that before, because as a former engineer, the last thing I understand anything about is romance. Just ask my wife. And then I thought, well, it can't just be a straight-up romance story. Let's add some sort of horrific element to it as well. And so I borrowed the idea of, for lack of a better term, psychic vampires, and integrated that while at the same time setting all this in the same milieu of, these are all based around artificial people, whether they're pure code, whether they're androids, or whether there's some bizarre synth hybrid. In this case, in the case of Cursed Hearts, that they are human, demonic, quasi-machines. And it just, in the sense of world building, that simply allows me to see what can I do and with this fundamental idea and take it somewhere else. So it's more of a question of, how can I look at different parts, not just locations, but also just look at how people are reacting to their situation differently than others, whether it is friends, families, lovers, special ops missions, and then most recently for my American Imperium trilogy, looking at things and writing about things from a military standpoint. So the world building, for me, I try to force myself to do things differently every time, because otherwise I'm simply plowing the same field and running the plow through the same furrows over and over and over again.
That's cool. That's cool.
Yeah.
And yeah.
So yeah.
Go ahead, Argy.
I didn't mean to throttle the conversation
no.
like that.
Oh no, we were listening in fascination to.
So the characters
very cool stuff.
Kind of. It builds, like, the characters and then the world around them, they build off each other in a way. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Oh, absolutely. Because
yeah,
it's very much a, not so much a feedback process, but likening it to DNA, it's more of a double helix in that they're constantly referring back to one another, in that their environment influences the characters influence the environment, and it then, to lose the metaphor, branches out more like a tree growing up from the ground, and then you have complex interconnections, because there are places in my books where you can see a character in one novel and they reference, they think, oh wait, wasn't that guy in the other novella?
Yeah.
And wasn't this person that one off was mentioned in one line? That was the main character back in this book.
I always love it when authors do that.
Yeah, and I don't mean to do that because I have some notes, especially when it comes to the more technical side of things, but it simply is this incredible mosaic. It's a three-dimensional mosaic in my mind, I guess, because of one of my backgrounds is design engineer. I think in three-dimensional terms. And so I see this space in my head, and I see all these massive interconnections, which I actually do try to describe once in Worlds Without End. And sometimes the plot says, okay, just for example, when I was at the end of my first novel, Fourth Law, the plot said, no, there's going to be a sequel to this. There's a bit of a mic drop right at the end. There's a bit of a cliffhanger. And as I was writing it, I simply, unlike Stephen with his 93,000 words, is I don't want to keep people on tenterhooks for that long. So I try to keep things around 60,000 words, because if you hate the story, I don't want you stuck for another 30 or 40,000 words. Just put the book down and move on. And plus, my writing style is much sparser than that. So in the case of, my first two novels, Fourth Law and Echoes, is that it was plot-driven, but in the case of what happened quite recently, two and a half years ago when I wrote, and 2 years ago when I published Worlds Without End, the central characters were 13-year-old Gary Hartman and his sister, Faustina, and part one was about their friend, Tracy, who was seeking to, for lack of a better term, shuffle off her mortal coil with a void, what we would have called the advanced internet. And the second part was the exact opposite of that, where since he was 3 years old, Gary Hartman had been in love with Henge, who is a thinking machine. And she is the only machine, in fact, this is what my children's early reader is, she's the only machine that wanted to be baptized and become Christian. And she, in the book, takes that to the next level of she's willing to abandon literal immortality as a pure code in order to spend time with the man she wants to marry.
Aww.
Now, whether or not that works out, that's entirely, you know, read the book and more importantly, pay for it. But in the course of doing that, writing about his Gary's very arrogant, stuck-up, younger little sister, 9-year-old sister, Faustina, because both Gary and his sister, their minds and nervous systems have been modified by the machines. So they think very fast. Their bodies are still human, so they don't have superpowers or anything like that. They just think differently and can see into the void differently than humans can. For Gary, he regards it almost as a curse. For Faustina, she embraces it, and the term that's being bandied about these days in politics, but she would call it machine supremacy. She thinks that in the term I discovered in the second of my trilogy about her, she calls it being demi-human, and she thinks that we're the ones that have to start running things, not you slow-thinking humans. And I sat on that idea for almost a year, and I would take notes occasionally. I wrote a few micro stories that I posted to my blog just to keep my hand in. And then it's one of those times you suddenly wake up and realize that, no, she's got to have her own book. And then when I started writing her story when she was 18, but because she thinks so differently and so much faster, she's much wiser and more dangerous than any of the humans around her in Lockville. And I quickly realized that, okay, just because she can raise her own private army and take Savannah, former Georgia, off the occupying Chinese Communist Army, what's to stop her? Where does her ambition end? And that suddenly went, oh, well, it doesn't. So I wrote a second book, and I realized, no, there's a third book, because she's going to bring the entire old American Deep South under her imperium, under her personal control. And when I first met her as this little girl in Worlds Without End, I thought, what an irritating little snot. And what she grew into surprised the daylights out of me. She realizes that pride is her besetting sin. Besotting? I'd have to reach out to my copy editor about that, but I don't think he's around.
You're doing good.
But she knows that's a problem, but she also draws strength from that. And you can almost, by the third book, see her peeling away from her Christian faith as she more and more relies simply upon herself. And ultimately, I think that's going to be a problem. I'm not entirely sure. But as I'd mentioned to Stephen before, this was a three-book trilogy. And by the time I got to the end, I went, oh, damn, another cliffhanger ending. It looks like it's going to be a four-book trilogy. And having written in the last 5 weeks two more micro stories, just sort of feeling things out, and it's actually entirely due to Daniel Dark, because I follow what he's doing to the Gentleman's Trolley on Instagram, Cigar Trolley, and it's absolutely beautiful what he's done. And I was just looking at some of the pictures, and I asked him about, well, does it have an air conditioning system? Because you're in Tennessee, after all, and it gets hot. And I, again, not me, the film started rolling again. And while looking at my phone and looking at Daniel Dark's Gentleman's Trolley, I thought, that's Faustina sitting in that chair. But she's not 19 anymore. She's in her early 40s. And sitting opposite her are three of her eight children, her three oldest adult male children, 22, 21, and 18. Sorry, 17. And why are they there? And I wrote a short story about that, and that short story is going to be the prologue of a book or a series of books that takes place quite literally a generation after the American Imperium trilogy. Because I could go into all the nitty-gritty details of what happens after she secures her Imperium, but I'm one for taking great leaps. One of the things that I learned very early on as a writer from Jerry Pournelle, and Jerry copying what he was told by Robert Heinlein, is start your stories in the middle. And I get some complaints about that in my reviews, that I jump around too much. I understand that, and I've tried to correct the most egregious failures of it, but I'm not about to abandon it. I firmly believe in the story has started. I don't know what's going on. The characters don't know what's going on. And the readers don't know what's going on, but we're all going to get on this roller coaster and find out. And so while I am currently more focused on trying to turn some of my existing books into audiobooks, I have already laid the groundwork for at least one, if not two more novels, simply because what they've shown me. And that's some, as you it pointed out, sometimes world building comes from the plot, and sometimes world building comes from the characters, and you've simply got to leave yourself open to that. You can't, I'm not arrogant enough to say, oh, this is how it's going to be. This is what you guys are going to do. No. And the few times I've tried that is I have gone, at one point, 6 weeks without writing. And my wife said, do I have to take you to a mental institution? Because, I mean, I was shaking. I was sweating constantly. I couldn't focus. And at home, that's one thing. It's like, okay, I can't even push the lawnmower straight. When you're working in a pharmacy as a technician, you don't exactly want to start killing people with your mistakes. So I had to simply say, I'm wrong. What do you people want to say? And then everything changed. I've learned my lesson. They're not always right, but I simply can't say it's going to be my way, because they're not always right, but I can almost guarantee you that I'm always wrong.
So what Clayton has shown us all is how a four-book trilogy can come into being and then become a five-book quadrology. So if you didn't think those things were possible, it's been explained on the Star Chamber show. There you go.
I thought I said that the trilogy is going to be what it is, and because of Stephen something,
multi-book trilogy,
did copy edit it, so he knows that the third book of the trilogy lands on something of another cliffhanger. But rather than simply rolling into a fourth book of the trilogy, no, I'm going to follow in line with Dr. Pornell and say, no, we're going to take a generational step. I absolutely refuse to discuss what happened between the time Faustina was 19 and when she was 43. We're going to take that jump. And I blame Daniel Dark for all
I once,
of this.
I was going to say, I once read a 9-book trilogy.
9-book trilogy. Nice.
Mm-hmm.
Is it one we would know?
Well, it was Piers Anthony. I don't know if you're familiar with the Xanth novels.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Absolutely.
Old school, old school.
The first five were really good, and then he started taking
Chameleon.
and they turned to shit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the first three were, I cut my teeth on those first three, those books. I was in the seventh grade when I read them.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. But yeah, but he referred to the first 9 books as the trilogy. And he was like, don't try to do the math. This is a trilogy.
I have to say one thing about Piers Anthony. He's known for the Xanth series. Oh, I was just going to say that real quick, though. Piers Anthony is so known for the Xanth series, everybody forgets, and he's got some pretty good stuff on other fronts, like the Apprentice Adept and the Incarnations of Immortality series, and some of those were some real fine work. And everybody always knows Xanth, but check out some of the other stuff, too, while you're at it. But over to you, Clayton. I had to give that brief Piers Anthony plug.
Give it a plug.
absolutely. It took me a while to realize that because he was writing from Florida, why all of his countries were peninsular in nature. And then later I realized that, he's from Florida, so he's slightly brain damaged.
Hey, maybe he's Florida man.
Exactly. Because if you ever want to know, the strangest possible police blotter reports, you always just Google Florida man.
Florida man. Florida man writes 9-book trilogy.
Well, you're just following in J.R.R. Tolkien's.
Oh, that's true.
He had The Hobbit and then The Lord of the Rings, which was the trilogy, but where would The Lord of the Rings be without The Hobbit?
Right, exactly.
Yep. Unless we forget, that was originally 6 books. That was originally 6 books in the way Tolkien originally envisioned it, and it was published as 3. So,
what I was about to say, that the publicist made that decision and took it out from under him. So if he had done it as 6 books, it would have been much closer to the more shorthand style that I do of 60 to no more than 70,000 words. And they said, no, we can do it. And then, of course, now you've got the big faux leather-bound tomes where it's all in one single book.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just all marketing and merchandising. And I oftentimes wonder that even given, because one of the things on my notes here is the difference in writing styles, is that Tolkien And this is one of the reasons why my wife never read The Lord of the Rings, but she listened to it on books on CD, which dates us. I didn't say books on cassette. That would have been even worse. Because, as she said, the man spends 10 minutes describing a leaf. And one of the other inklings, C.S. Lewis, will say, the children stood in the forest, and then immediately launches into dialogue, and everyone's talking at that point. And you say, it's up to the reader to say, well, okay, they're in a forest, and everybody has a preconceived notion of a forest, and most people are good with that. Whereas Tolkien would say, first of all, let me describe every leaf on every tree, and then give you the 500-year history of this goddamn forest.
Yep.
And nobody cares. Obviously, he cared deeply about it, and that's fine for him, and that's fine for people that appreciate that style of writing. My sense of writing is much more Lewisian in that regard, in that I'll say, quite literally, she stood in a desert, a washed-out sky. She looked around, and then they start talking. At one point in a book convention years ago, I had somebody who probably does not want to be mentioned by me, so I won't, look at my first three books, and he said, oh, the structure of these, this is a screenplay. And I was very young and stupid by experience, not by age, going back to what Stephen said. And I went, what? And he said, here. He took out a piece of paper, and he made a series of line, all the same, like big blocks of lines. And then he took another page and made line, line, line. And he said, that, the first one with blocks, whether it's text or description, is a novel, where it's talking back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. That's a screenplay. Because you set the scene, the camera sets the scene. What you need to do is listen to what they're saying to each other. And he said, you are writing screenplays. And I went, okay, is that good or bad? And he said, it's you. Do what you can do. And I've honestly never looked back at that point. So I will still say, you know, Faustina listened to the water dripping from the wet pines just outside of Aplica, Alabama, and then I launch into the discussion she has with her legates. I am not going to describe exactly where the sun was. I'm not going to describe exactly what the temperature was or how muddy the ground was. I simply said that they were standing under the wet pines. And what she and her legates are talking about comes to the battle, that makes all the difference in the world, because that is the story. Just as in real life, our story is how we interact with each other. Our story is not how, unlike the existentialist, is not how we go out and hug a tree. Our story is interaction with other people, as painful as it is for somebody like me. And that's what I'm trying to convey in my novels.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah,
I mean, I think
I
don't think there's something to be said for each writing style. You know, if someone asked me to compare Lewis to Tolkien and say which one is the better writer, I would say that's not a choice that can be made.
it's an absolute false dichotomy.
Yeah.
And then Charles Williams, if you're speaking of the Inklings, you still got him too.
Yeah,
another one.
Charles Williams, the best thing he had going was that hard-headed realism. And he was the one that whenever Tolkien would start and Williams would lean back and go, oh, my God, not the goddamn elves again.
Yes, that's a classic response. Yeah,
I love it.
And that's reason 8 million why I'd love to be a fly on the wall during those discussions. But, yeah, good stuff.
And just like what I intimated earlier when I was quoting Hemingway, is what were they doing? The Inklings were drinking at a pub. These people were drinking. They were smoking. They were not eating soy. They were not sipping lattes. No, they were drinking and smoking, and that's what the best writers do.
Oh, well, that's true. They were definitely, yeah, that was a definite pub situation, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But getting into the storytelling styles and so forth, you have talked often about voices, and I've exchanged messages with you. You know, you've complained when certain characters of yours have demanded attention, and so you talk about the development of the stories themselves in terms of the voices and how they come to you, and how that's led to, I mean, obviously you have many female leads and then also, your unique voices that have kind of emerged. Talk about how the voices have worked with constructing the plots of your work.
It has been rather strange, to be honest. I guess if I was laying on a couch being analyzed by some deviant Freudian, they would say that, because you're married to an Hungarian and those women have been liberated since the 9th century, both of your daughters are adopted Chinese orphanage immigrants, and so they are by definition extremely hard-headed as well. No, I don't think that particularly enters into it, and even though a lot of the early characters in my stories are something of a clean lift from my family, it doesn't explain something like Nicole Five, who is an android from Somi Corporation in Osaka, Japan, who is trying to save civilization in Portland, Oregon, sent there at the behest of the new empress, another damn woman, of Japan, Togame. So, where did that come from? I don't know. And in Cursed Hearts, the protagonist is male. He has his step cousin, later girlfriend, Katarina Sosabowski, who is half Japanese, half Polish. But, and then, of course, the Goddess Crusade, Empress Crusade, Princess Crusade, the American Imperium trilogy. Faustina and her brother Gary are half men Chinese from their mother. They're half Prussian from Leslie Hartmann, their father, who is the great-grandnephew of Erich Hartmann, the greatest German ace ever in World War II. So when it comes to voices, I don't know why. It's not a majority. I'd say it's certainly a plurality I have of strong female leads, and I really don't fully grasp why that is. And it's not for me to say. As I said earlier, when it comes to the, not the fourth book, but the next series of books after the American Imperium trilogy, because I'm going to hold it as a trilogy, is that it involves the oldest three sons of Faustina. Well, obviously, all parts 1, 2, and 3 of that book are going to be centered around these young men. But for whatever reason, it did turn out that way. And since quite recently, the last 8 months or so, I had the bone banged out of my head that a lot of people, both in person and online, were saying that, wow, you write books, and from your description, they sound really interesting, but I don't have time to read. And, it'd be nice, but I just can't do that right now. And then they'll go on to say that, I was listening to this podcast. Well, I was listening to this book on whatever downloaded form they have, or I was reading this book, and I realized that, most people, to enjoy a novel, they're listening to it. And So when it quite literally came to voices, I went, all right, I'm going to have to start recording audiobooks. I look at my backyard because it's winter, and son of a bitch, the magic money tree has all of the $100 bills off of it because it's winter. So I'm going to do this myself. And I thought about which ones I should do first, and for a variety of reasons, which maybe we can come back to, I decided to do Nicole Five's two books, Friend and Ally, Foes and Rivals, because they are a blend of their science fiction, their military, their politics, there's romance, and I thought this is a good cross-section of Mycene civilization. And again, the problem was, okay, the lead character, Nicole Five Clark, is a artificial person made from Somi Corporation in Oska. As y'all have been hearing for the last several minutes, I don't exactly have a particularly feminine voice. Because doing an audiobook, you can just, especially if it's a technical work or a non-fiction work, you just read it. You're simply narrating it straight off the page. If it is a fiction book, it behooves whoever is reading it, whether it's the author or somebody that is hired, paid, etc. At that point, you have a voice actor or actress. Oh, look, I just said something sexist. And I first had to buy the equipment. Wasn't much, $150, nice microphone, etc. And then download Audacity, teach myself how to use it back in July. And then I started looking at videos of how to voice characters on audiobooks. And more, one of the most important were two, oddly enough, they were both British, that were how do you voice female characters if you're a guy? And one of the things they said is that you've got to push the voice up to the roof of your mouth and into your nose, out of your throat. Because when Nicole Five is talking, especially because she is very young in the world, physically she's only 4 years old, and she's so excited to be sent by her empress to Portland, and she wants to help everyone so much, but she is so young, and would you please, please help make me older about what you're trying to do. So I can at least try to pitch my voice.
Wow.
Up and
that's
out for
really
that.
Good.
And, at
same time, and at the same time, I had to decide who's an NPC, which is just basically my, what you're hearing now, my neutral talking voice. And then who actually gets their own voice. Because I don't have the mental capacity to keep all these things straight. And even, trust me, in about 2 weeks when I finally do release Friend and Ally, people are going to look at that and go, I'm hoping they say that, well, it's his first time and he's never done it before. So I'm going to give him 3 stars instead of 1 because he was trying. because down here I've got Gilhaven. Gilhaven speaks in kind of blunt declamatory. And then Joe Kreeft, man, he's like he's from the Midwest. He just talks like that. and then there's Nike. Nike runs Zom's, the most wonderful pub in town. Oh, and Nike is also a flaming homosexual. And then there's General Tedmer, who has one of the regulars of the army, like what's left of goddamn Portland, Oregon. And when I had to do the 2 chapters of General Tedmer, I couldn't talk for a week afterward. because it tore my voice up so bad.
Yep.
But so many of these, you have to decide, does this person get a voice? Does that person get a voice? And then what's so much worse, even with notes in the margins, is you have to remember all this. And trust me, mm-hmm. I drop the ball. I know for a fact I screw up the voice of the mayor in name, but the dictator of Portland, Oregon, I know for a fact I've screwed his up. And I've tried very hard on the voice of Teresa Johnson, his daughter, because as my wife said, well, she should sound like Lauren Bacall. And I said, Jesus Christ, do you think I can sound like Lauren Bacall? I mean, if I could, do you think I'd be living in Newark, Ohio, for Christ's sakes?
That's amazing.
So yes, I have to hear this book now.
I know. Like, I'm invested.
Yeah, I have to hear it day one when it gets released now. This is great.
Yep. I'll be like sitting there, okay, which character is Lauren Bacall?
Since I couldn't do Lauren Bacall, this is an incredibly obscure reference. Oh, that's my wife getting ice for my drink in the background. She's a wonderful waitress. Is that from from the very old album of John and Vangelis and the song Friends of Mr. Cairo, there is a single line spoken by a female hired to say this line, "Don't worry about me, I'm okay." And I pitched that too low. I actually pitch it higher. "Don't worry about me, I'm okay." And I used that one line, and over and over and over and over again in my head, that's what I've modeled for Teresa Johnson. Because she's multi-mixed race, the daughter of the mayor dictator of Portland. She's a brilliant computer engineer in the master's program. And Nicole Five later convinces her to go into politics in an attempt to create a monarchical system, which we can come back to later, is a constant thread throughout all of my novels, is that liberal democracy is a fundamentally failed system and monarchy is what humans are designed for. And you laugh. See, you people.
No, I'm not laughing. I just was just like, classic Clayton. Oh, man. I love it.
And so
I'm fascinated.
I practiced very hard with her voice to try to get it right, because she inhabits both books and plays an extremely significant role. But as much as I screw up her father, I tried much harder to get her voice correct. And because back in July, when I first played with the hardware and software, for 1 hour, I would actually record in my basement. I built a little fortress of quietude of everything was covered with carpets and sonic tiles and things like acoustic tiles.
Well done.
It would take me three hours to try to flog it to where it would meet ACX standards.
Mm-hmm.
And now that I'm a bit older on how that's done, I've looking over to my left, I've got two pages of notes of step-by-step, this is how you do it. And I've got it down to 1 hour of recording is about 90 minutes of editing. And I am very hopeful that I can get Friend and Ally commercially available. My original thought was Easter. Now I'm honestly thinking I can do it by the end of March.
Nice.
And if I
That's
do,
exciting.
I'll be sure to post it to all of y'all so that you can criticize me mercilessly for saying, dude, you totally botched the voices. Totally.
I doubt that, knowing how meticulous you are. But yeah, go ahead, Archie.
Well, I just want to say, like, because I listen to a lot of audiobooks and a lot of, like, you know, podcasts, like character podcasts and stuff like that. What a lot of actors miss, or voice readers miss, which I think that you are understanding, is that when you're doing like a gender swap voice, you don't have to go up here. You know, you just get the elements. You just kind of move the voice into a different part of your mouth. You add the feminizing elements, and it creates like the listener. Then, you know, we're in that state of suspension of disbelief. And it just, you go with it, and that's it. And it's a completely different thing than trying to mimic a voice. You know, you're not mimicking. You're just adding a layer of that character onto your own voice, and it works. And when a voice reader doesn't do that, it kind of takes you out of the story. And, like, as you were doing those voices just now, I was thinking back to stories that I've listened to, and I was like, man, I wish that story had done what he's doing right now. So so I'm actually excited to hear it, because I think it's going to be really good.
Well, I appreciate that, and I hope so. However, one of the things this has taught me doing this very first audiobook is I know my own limitations. That's one of the reasons I'm thinking of doing another, my novella Crosses and Double Crosses next, because Sylvia Fernandez, and no, I'm not even going to try a voice right now, because she's aristocratic Spanish Filipino raised in Manhattan. So I've got to come up with that. But it's going to be a very rich voice. Still think I can pull it off.
Yeah.
And almost everyone else in the novella is male, so that's not going to be a problem.
Yeah.
But when it comes to, for example, my most recent trilogy that I've released, is that Faustina, I know I cannot do that. Mm-hmm. I cannot do an 18, 19-year-old, gingineered, fanatically egotistical young woman who has utter faith in herself and is very, you know, probably a very declamatory style, but also being born and raised in Knoxville, she's going to have slight Southern hill country elements in it.
I know for a fact
I can't do that. I simply will need to find someone who can. I'm not one to normally pay attention to other humans. Shocking, I know.
Mm-hmm.
And there is actually someone I know at my day job that I have encountered intermittently, because the nature of our jobs don't touch besides being in an elevator. And
right.
She has a very Midwestern declamatory style, and at some point I am planning to approach her and say, look, if you're interested in this, and I'll explain voice acting, I'm going to pay you X number of dollars to read this, but first we have to have literally an audition, because I want you to read the whole book, but I'll explain the character to her and the nature of the character. And you've got to some degree get inside this person's head and speak like she does. And if she can, then fantastic. I just solved my problem. And I've solved my problem without even leaving my comfort zone, because this is somebody that I know at work. And that would be a most elegant solution to voicing this trilogy, which is a very important story. Character development, not only of Faustina, but all of the people around her, and the new sense of government she establishes. But if it doesn't work, I'm not exactly sure what to do. I don't know if there's such a thing as going on Fiverr for looking for voice actresses.
You about find every talent, type of talent on Fiverr,
Well, and doesn't, I know you mentioned Audacity, doesn't the AXC or whatever it's called, don't they have an audition option where you can, like,
audition out for parts? Mm-hmm. They do.
Because I think a friend of mine auditioned her book out and found a voice actor that way.
I
have not looked at it in any detail, to be perfectly honest. Did I mention the fact that it's winter and the magic money tree is all barren right now? So my suspicion is that if I go through ACX, I'm going to find people that are looking for four, if not five figures, and that is patently unacceptable.
Oh, no, you can do it by, I mean, you should look into it, because I know you can do it either by, like, lump payment, or you can do royalty.
Royalty,
which,
share.
Like,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Or they have a hybrid category, too.
I don't know as much about it as I sound like I do, but.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, RG. No, RG, you're right. We do it all the time.
The
I mean, we.
Yeah.
The only thing I would
have
with royalty share is that that's potentially saying that you have a continuing interest in the monetization of this audiobook. I am not as paranoid as a very good friend of mine, Will Dion. He's in Columbus, a fantastic graphic artist, and the one who actually mentioned earlier about that text on November 3rd that got me going. And he keeps everything extremely closely held, too much in my opinion. And I don't, but the problem is I always want complete creative control over my work. And if somebody says, oh, well, now you have royalty payments over your voice over my book, then you've re-entangled me into somebody else's life. And that gets my hackles up. I would
rather flat out say,
here, here's X number of dollars, read the damn script, and I never want to see you again.
Right.
Do you happen to have a college or high school or anything like that with an arts program close by you?
Ooh, that's a good one. Yep.
I live in a bedroom community to just east of Columbus, Ohio, and we've got things like that thick on the ground. In fact, as a tiny little side story, which always brings a chuckle to my face because it's so goddamn stupid, is that a very good friend of daughter number one back in high school went on to Otterbein and is majoring in creative writing. So for $30,000 a year, she is just completing her second year, $60,000. In that time, she has written and published absolutely nothing. I have written and published two novels, one novella, one short story collection. So I am kind of leery when it comes to colleges because they are scams. Now, if there was something more like technical writing, perhaps I could look into it. I'm not sure where I would begin to advertise something like that, Dan.
Just go into the arts department, talk to one of the professors in there.
Yeah, talk to the head of the department. Because we got a lot of regional auditions that way, people would contact the head of the department, and then she would then, like, you know, grabbed the handful of students that she thought was a good fit for it. I mean, it was almost like mm-hmm. having an agent.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
We did it. You know, we were still in college. We didn't know any better. We did it for the experience. So, you know, there's something.
The experience is a lot cheaper than money. You know.
Mm-hmm.
Different things like that.
Because it's something they can put on their creative resume. Like, they can put it on their acting resume as a voice actor. If, you know, if that's something that they want to do.
Okay. That is an idea I have not considered before, and I will definitely look into that in the coming days. I appreciate both of you for making me older.
For making you
very
older?
Nice. Yep. No, that means more experience, more knowledgeable. That's Clayton speak.
I see. Okay.
I defined earlier. Yes. You'll get used to it.
Okay.
Yeah, more you interact with Clayton. Yeah. You'll get he will be known for that word.
I think that was in a C.S. Lewis book once too. In one of the Hidden Planet books.
Yes, just like any writer, there is nothing new under the sun, and I rip off absolutely everyone that I can get a hold of. And
yes.
That comes straight off of Paralanda.
I love it. I am a strong advocate of nothing new under the sun. I just got into an argument about it last week. So, yes, we're of like mind in that respect.
I seem to recall I said something in the chat room about that last week, too, agreeing with you.
Yes.
I love it.
That is true. That is true.
See?
But
Star Chamber Show, bringing people together. I love it.
It does.
No matter how
we're the solution. Oh, gosh. No, we're a good bunch here. But what I was going to also, I wanted to bring across, and I know it's not as exciting as some of the other aspects of audiobooks, but you have put a lot of effort into it. Give folks an appreciation of the amount of time that is involved in the production of an audiobook, because people think that it's just as easy as just, oh, I'm just going to turn on the recorder and read a book. And it is not like that at all. And give people a sense of what is involved in terms of the workload to produce an audiobook and what you've been through and what is behind the scenes.
First of all, you've got to have some basic equipment. I started off May of last year from absolute zero. And so I discovered a Wikipedia article. I don't have it at hand because I don't. And it was, here are some of the basics of some of the equipment you can buy, starting from $50 up to $5,000. Yeah, I'm going for about $150. Thank you very much. And the need to have a quiet space. COVID-19 is a disease. Yes, it was engineered by the Chinese. And yes, the American reaction to it is absolutely hysteric and retarded. So as a result of that, the two little recording studios that exist in Newark, Ohio are shut down. So as a result, that's why I had to go into my basement, find the quietest corner possible, and fling blankets on top of everything, put empty paint canvases behind me and cover them with acoustic tiles to create a very quiet space in my basement, set up all the hardware, download Audacity, download multiple different versions on YouTube as to how to use Audacity, and then rather than trying to be meticulous about it, I said, let's just see what I can do. And between May, June, and July, I recorded, knowing that I wanted to do Friend and Ally first, I recorded the prologue, chapters 1, 2, and 3, and they were pretty much, it was just like the first time I wrote that raw manuscript back in November of 2014. It was awful. Absolutely awful. I didn't have the voices right. I didn't have the timing right. I would pause when I shouldn't. I would rush through things that I shouldn't have. And when I tried to go back through and edit them, I didn't know what the hell I was doing. And all of a sudden, I'd be listening through it through my headphones going, there should be my voice right here, and it's dead silent for 17 seconds. What the Christ did I just do? So my learning curve was incredibly steep. And however, I did learn a lot. Then I wrote down some notes and I pushed them all aside because from August on, my sole objective was to get the physical books done of the American Imperium Trilogy. I had to get those done, prioritized above all else. Excuse me. And now, getting back to that in early February, I reoriented myself. I got out pieces of paper. I got out my old notes. And I went back to all those videos, and this time I wrote out line by line, which I can go over here. So step one, always do mic check, minus 18 to minus 6. Two, use MME. Three, project rate, 44,100 hertz, 16-bit, preferably 24 if you're doing ACX. Four, record ambient room noise for 3 to 5 seconds, paint effect, noise removal, and on and on and on to 19 different steps just to edit. And that has nothing to do with editing mistakes. Because what I also learned was, as I'm reading things downstairs, whether it's in my voice or whether it's in Nicole Nye's voice, is that sooner or later, is that I do that. And so you make a big pop sound, which makes a huge spike on the audio meter.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you're coming back through to edit it, oh, there's a huge spike. How did I screw this up? So you paint that out. And after you make a mistake, you go back and try to do it right again. And so you eliminate those. A lot of the plosives, even though I have the spit filter in front of it, I still do that. Even though Logitech, damn you to hell, I'm looking at it in my right hand right now, the silent mouse, well, the silent mouse still shows up in Audacity. So
wow.
Damn Logitech to hell. So I had to go back, and every single time I scrolled down, I had to remove that tiny little scroll down sound. Two edit passes is what I've got so far through chapter 3, but it's getting faster each time. So first pass through is egregious mistakes, where I'm talking along about this story, and I have to say something, and I have to say something. So edit that out. Get rid of the little mouse sounds. Get rid of, oh, I didn't know that daughter number 2 came home and just flushed the toilet. Oh, look, the dogs are barking. Fan-effing-tastic. Get rid of that. And then to flog things into shape to get it past ACX. Again, I do these things, but I don't know what they are. Normalize, equalization, compressor, amplify.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Limiter. Mm-hmm. And then once you do all that,
yeah,
you go back. And still, every other chapter, I still run into RMS error, which means the ratio of how quiet things are to how noisy things are is buggered up. And fortunately, I found a way in Audacity to fix that, but I was about ready to abandon the entire audiobook project when I first encountered this error and how ACX says, this is how you fix it. No, there's a much simpler way to do it in Audacity, thanks be to God. And that's how I've been fixing it up to date and getting it past those people. And it's working much faster. As I said, I went from 1 hour of recording to 3 hours of editing to 1 hour of recording to an hour and a half of editing. Now that I've completely recorded Friend and Ally, when I do the sequel, Foes and Rivals, I think I'll be able to cut it one to one. Hour of speaking, hour of editing.
Very nice.
It was a massive uphill battle. I know that one time you had me on for 30 minutes when your intended was talking about editing and formatting. And formatting for ACX is astonishingly difficult. It is less difficult now, but this is speaking in March of 2021. When I was staring at my myriad error messages that I got back in July of 2020, I didn't even know where to begin to fix it. I had no frame of reference for, well, what are you saying is wrong? Because I don't even know how to make that right. So it's not as bad as I thought. Just like everything else, you've got to be older in this, and it takes time and patience and a tremendous amount, especially for someone like me who originally has an engineering background. It takes a tremendous amount of humility to say that just because I'm sitting in front of a computer, I don't have the slightest idea what I'm doing. I have no clue. I can write these stories. I can create these worlds. I've got a dozen published books. I've got 800,000 words of machine civilization stretching over 300 years, and I can't get the main character's voice right. It's an incredibly, not humiliating in the sense of bad, it's a sense of, why don't you reassess who you are and what you can do? And why don't you start over and get it right this time? And in that sense, I very much appreciate, and this time I'll say it in American English, as a learning experience, just so Stephen doesn't have to correct me again.
No, you've done well, man. It's been, and you've applied your engineering mindset to it very, very assiduously. And wow, yeah, I'm looking forward to this audiobook. It's going to be fun. You do have a great voice, so I mean, I'm confident it's going to come out very well. Yeah, I'm not worried.
That, but no homo, Stephen.
No, but no. Oh boy.
But, oh my goodness.
He's too much. Oh yeah. Well, it's Clayton. But before as the show is getting a couple of minutes away from the end here, I do want to give you a chance to promote the American Imperium trilogy and your other works and direct people to where to get them, most importantly, because I definitely hope some folks do pick up your work and try out Machine Civilization.
Even though it is operating under the enemy radar, so to speak, as Sarah Hoyt, another brilliant science fiction authoress, has put it, is that a lot of our works as indies come out under Amazon self-publishing. If they ever really knew what we were up to, we would all be banned in the blink of an eye. I know that Sarah is working on alternatives to that, and I'm not going to address it because she could be blown out of the water. So, but at the time, as for now, most of my books, both in electronic and physical format, can be found on Amazon. Everything except the American Imperium trilogy can be found on Smashwords. And I'm hoping to port the Imperium Crusade trilogy over there probably in the next 2 weeks on Smashwords. Nice. If you're interested, my first two novels of The First Law and Echoes of Family Loss are free. I did not want to do that on Amazon, and in fact, it's impossible to make something free on Amazon. But
I'll show you a trick later. Get back with me on that. I got a trick for that.
it's one of those things, just like any drug dealer, you know, the first one's always free. So I want to get people interested in Machine Civilization out there. And as an aside to that, that's one of the reasons my children's early reader, if you look at it, every single character in there is – most of them are characters from Tribe Tosca, the AI mm-hmm. family from mm-hmm. Hamamas. And so it's, oh, well, I read this when I was in first grade, and here's this other book, and it seems to have the same characters in it. So I am actually that selfish and that self-centered a son of a bitch that I figure if I can get kids interested in Machine Civilization when they're reading, you know, the Cumstain Bears or whatever the hell they're called these days, that they will be more likely to start reading my other novels once they're older.
No, it's good stuff. Good stuff. But great cover art, too. Folks, on the Imperium trilogy, I mean, you have some very eye-catching cover art, too. So when you look those up, there won't be any problem seeing those on the page on Amazon. And Smashwords, as you said, which is a great outlet. And glad you're not exclusive there, because I can't stand exclusivity to Amazon for many reasons, but I'm glad you're also on Smashwords.
And toward the cover art, it's the artist is Claudia Sperl from Hessen. I was wrong. I thought it was Saxony. She corrected me. I'm sorry. Women are always correcting me. What happened? But from Hessen, just down from the Fulda Gap, and Label Schmielte, good luck on that. You can look it up online. And I started off with her on 99 Designs, which is also a fantastic mm-hmm. website. It's just that mm-hmm. She and I got very used to each other's styles and very used to mm-hmm. how we both think. And she was able to get inside my OODA when it comes to characters. And she is going to be doing covers for me for quite some time. She's absolutely brilliant.
Wonderful. Yeah, she did a great job on those. So, it's been wonderful finally having you in the featured guest chair. I got everything I was hoping for, the classic Clayton, the in-depth, scope of your world. I mean, it's been a great night, and definitely want to have you back sooner than later to visit again, of course. But I'm going to have to, on my end, I'm going to have to sign off, and then I'll turn over to you for a final comment, and then RG and Daniel take us out. But this is Stephen, and thank you for listening to Star Chamber Show, and we will catch up with you next Wednesday for another episode at 9 Eastern. So over to you, Clayton, for final thought, and then RG and Daniel.
As always, I appreciate you very much for tolerating me for all this time. I'm not sure, but judging by the flashing lights from the street outside of my house, I'm guessing these are the federal agents about to take me to the FEMA camps. So I'll be writing the rest of my story from there. In the meantime, it's an absolute pleasure working with all of you. And I would, again, especially like to thank Daniel Dark for posting those pictures of the gentleman's trolley, because it has engendered an entirely new series of novels by me. Thank you, all of you.
And I've had an absolute blast chatting with everyone this evening. You can check everything out about me at rgwesterman.com. There's always updates happening there. And in the meantime, I will see you next time.
And this is Daniel Dark. As always, we strive to bring you important information on your creative front that you can get good nuggets from and be able to be more creative yourself. And next week we hope to keep that tradition going. And until we see you then, be creative. This is Daniel Dark signing out.